This is Unfortunate History.
Hey, what's up, everybody? You're listening to Unfortunate History. This is a podcast where we cover crazy, wacky, unfortunate events from history and the people involved with them. And today, I am joined... Oh, crap. No, I forgot to introduce myself. You guys need to know me. My name is Cody Pennington, and with me from last week is Sam Brown. Sam, how's it going, man?
It is good, thank you, sir. Thank you again. Thank you for having me back.
Of course. How's your week been?
Somewhat the same as last week, one may argue. At the moment, I teach 2 days a week, which has moved online, which has been really fortunate at this time, because otherwise all my gigs are gone. And so a lot of my time is spent just trying to make those as good as possible, like having good content, doing videos and stuff for them. That practicing, exercising, all the rest of it. And then I definitely probably have drank more than I would normally drink.
I think that's everybody. So Sam and I were talking before we started the podcast, and we were just talking about today's episode, and today's episode is going to be a bit more historically heavy, but not in a terrible way. Hopefully it'll be in a very interesting way for you, because the person we'll be talking about today had a little bit of a mark on American history near around the time of the American Revolution, and hopefully you'll find his story very interesting, because he was an interesting fellow. Today we're going to be talking about Lord Timothy Dexter. I say Lord Timothy with quotation marks, and we'll get to that story in a little bit.
Bought it over the internet kind of thing?
Probably, yeah. Speaking of, I'm actually a registered minister. I've been a registered minister since 2013. Thank you, internet.
Of course you are. That's incredible.
If any of our listeners want me to officiate their wedding, I'm more than happy to do so.
I only just learned this about you.
Yeah. Yeah, you're welcome, right? It's crazy, right? Facts about Cody. It's crazy. Well, Lord Timothy Dexter, like I said, he was an uneducated man born in the 1700s. And I can't stress uneducated enough. I have to stress it. It will come into play in the story. But he was born in the 1700s, and his entire life embodied luck and fortune. He became one of the richest men in America following the Revolutionary War, but only by pure happenstance. His life is quite possibly one of the most odd in history, and he very likely knew this to be true. Or, at least, that might have been his goal, to make his life the most odd in history. And today, we'll cover the man who you may hate from the very beginning, but quite possibly might love by the end of the story.
I am hooked.
Just an interesting intro. That's all you need. Interesting intros. Well, Lord Timothy Dexter was born in 1743 in Malden, near Boston. I think it actually was a small town, potentially part of Boston. But he was born into a family of farm laborers, effectively birthing him into the lower class, a fact which haunted Timothy to his dying day. And in his late teens, Timothy undertook an apprenticeship with a leather dresser in his hometown. Interestingly, this occupation, though still considered a lower-class job, was quite profitable for Dexter's station. Further, luckily for Timothy, the leather dressers in the Boston area, including all of his teachers, had become very good in the art of crafting Moroccan leather, which was a very in-vogue type of leather with colonial fashionistas at the time. Basically, and effectively, the Bostonian leather dressers monopolized the market for Moroccan leather.
Right. Sorry, it's the comment that you made about him like feeling haunted by his lower class.
I don't even think haunted does it justice. He hated that fact about himself, that he was born into the lower class. I can't stress it enough. It's crazy, but he was so obsessed with the fact that he was lower class.
I'm so looking forward to the rest of this now.
Well, luckily enough for Timothy, and obviously we're going to be saying that so much throughout this story, but luckily enough, the fact that his teachers had become very proficient with Moroccan leather meant that he was in a perfect place to learn a skill that put him in a very profitable position. Now, following the completion of his apprenticeship at the age of 21, he decided to go into business for himself, making use of his in-demand leather dressing abilities. However, the situation in Boston at this time was incredibly unstable. And for a bit of context, this moment in time in world history, America and Great Britain, their relationship was becoming quite strained. Britain was suffering financially due to the French and Indian War, and that was a war to decide who would rule North America. And Britain felt that America should foot the bill for this. This brought on many legislative acts from Britain to America, implementing taxes on many different goods.
I like that. He's like, we think America should foot the bill. It's like they were doing Trump with the wall before.
Exactly. Yeah. They were like, we won the right to rule you. Now you're going to pay for it.
give us the money to pay for our other wars.
Yeah. Now, America felt, obviously, that this was really unfair. But specifically, the reason they felt this was unfair was the fact that no representatives in America were allowed to represent America in Parliament to argue these taxes. This led to the America's fight against taxation without representation, which further led to the Boston Tea Party, which further led to the American Revolution. And Sam, as a British gentleman, are you familiar with the Boston Tea Party?
Now, I'm very glad you asked, because my American history is... In fact, my history in general is beyond rubbish for someone who once studied archaeology and classical civilizations. But all I can say is I've heard of the Boston Tea Party, but I'm getting a sense it isn't, you know, like, what am I thinking? Tea at noon, crumpets and cream.
No. Nothing like Alice in Wonderland. No, nothing like that. It was actually a pretty big moment in history, but it's an interesting moment. Just to touch on it a bit, the Boston Tea Party, there were particular British legislations enacted following the taxes that they had placed on America. They actually enacted legislation to allow the British East India Company to sell tea from China to America, effectively tax-free. Now, that wasn't necessarily fair in America because they were trying to tax the bejesus out of America, and they taxed every other company. Well, they decided to do this tax-free for the company, but they also wanted the company to simultaneously charge the American colonists a hidden tax on each pound of tea. That would in turn be paid to London to basically get the money back that England was trying to get from Americans. American colonists discovered that tax was on that tea. They stormed the East India Company ships and threw 92,000 pounds of tea into the ocean, and this event, along with others, led to the Revolutionary War.
Sure, this is all bringing back memories for me now. But as a Brit, I mean, like, I've gone through my phases with tea. I'm probably more of a coffee person now, but I know that I've got friends out there that are going to be thinking, oh God, the tea. Or more importantly, looking at the ocean in this beautiful, rosy, almost He-Man-like skin hue.
And just jumping in and just drinking as much as possible.
Yeah, swimming.
It's really funny, but that was around the time that England had started to become obsessed with tea. Or a little bit before that, they'd become obsessed with tea, but then they were trying to also, the companies wanted to start selling it in America, so they tried to get Americans hooked on the tea, and that's kind of where that kind of came from. But then after this, Americans started to slowly not enjoy tea as much as the British.
And they were like, then they discovered coffee, and now I think, would you argue is more popular now?
In America or in England?
I mean, America, I know it's the coffee thing because when I recently went, the fact that everyone just comes around with free refills is incredibly dangerous to me, but I loved every second of it.
Yeah, free refills all day, baby, all day.
Oh, okay.
Waffle House, if you ever go to Waffle House, it's just constant. You can go there just for coffee and drink for 3 days straight. It's crazy.
Yeah, I think for me it was... I think it's the fact that they kind of don't even ask. They just do it. And I'm like, yeah. I could live here.
Yeah.
This is great. I could do this. But I do, like, also, I think, like, I do have friends who are very tea-centric, but I think being a musician, most of my friends are probably more coffee-centric.
Yeah, I'd say so. Long, long late nights on the road and stopping off. I can't stop off for a spot of tea at a petrol station. I've got to get some coffee in me, or realistically, I'll probably die. I don't want to wreck my car and fall asleep and wreck my car. It's a matter of life and death. So coffee it is for me. Thank you. Now, as the country fell into the Revolutionary War, Timothy decided to take his marketable skills of leather dressing to the nearby hub of Charleston, which is about 4 miles away from his hometown. Making use of his skills he developed during his apprenticeship, Timothy quickly found a decent amount of success. As luck would have it, his skills were somewhat recession-proof, so he continued to see a rise in profits. And Timothy Dexter was undoubtedly one of the most fortunate and eventually unfortunate people from all of history, like we said. We will be using the terms luck, lucky, and every other similar word throughout this episode, because those were the most descriptive words to use to describe Lord Timothy Dexter. He was obviously lucky that his career continued to grow throughout one of history's most important wars, but he was also very lucky with his move to Charleston, not just because of his profits, but also due to the fact that he met and somehow wooed his now wife, Elizabeth Frothingham.
Frothingham is a fantastic name.
Is it?
I mean...
Is it really?
I can't believe that it's not British. This is Miss Elizabeth Frothingham.
Well, they were the colonists. I mean, obviously, they had been there for a while, but they were still British in origin.
Very true.
Yeah. Well, Elizabeth Frothingham was a wealthy widow of one of Dexter's former leather associates. However, she was not just wealthy. She was incredibly wealthy, especially in comparison to Timothy. Elizabeth had developed her fortune as a huckster, selling goods door to door. And before I say this next point, I have to say that I believe wholeheartedly in equality between the sexes. But in this time, there were obviously certain expectations on women inside the household. Because of this, this feat was unbelievably impressive. Obviously, women were expected to raise the children and care for the home. Again, that's not my view of how things should be, but Elizabeth's industrious aptitude has to be described, at least to give her the credit she deserves.
So, just to clarify that, so she was basically a very successful door-to-door salesman.
She was.
Wow.
Yeah, saleswoman.
Saleswoman.
A very successful door-to-door saleswoman. Yeah, she,
very cool.
She made a fortune out of it, actually. And I don't know if she made her fortune before or after her husband had died, but either way, she still developed her own fortune on her own. In a time, the 1700s were not a great time for women business owners.
I wonder if there's like a Carol Baskin situation going on there. Maybe she realized just how much she was worth. And when she was writing up the will, she was like, oh, you're not having that, any of that.
Carol Baskin, the second Tiger King reference in 2 weeks.
Sorry.
Keep them going.
We're milking that one now.
Yeah, I think I've been making references to how people should be grandfathers by their mid-20s for the last 3 weeks now. So, I don't know. We need to find new material. But we're just starting out with this. We're trying our best, man. Now, in relation to Timothy, he did not necessarily see Elizabeth as a strong wife. More than that, Timothy saw in Elizabeth a financial opportunity. Now, following their marriage, Dexter set out to ingratiate himself into the upper class of Charleston, because as we said, he hated being lower class. Having come from somewhat humble beginnings and then coming into money, albeit by marriage, Timothy felt a constant need to progress in his professional life and to be seen as one of America's nobility, or at the very least, to be accepted by them. And there was pretty good reason for this, because his neighbors in Charleston included some incredibly influential people of American history, such as John Hancock, who was the first to sign the Declaration of Independence, and Thomas Russell, one of the richest men in the country at the time. Being typically upper class, these men were well-versed in etiquette and business affairs, to which Dexter was not. He was severely uneducated. I cannot state that enough. He was severely uneducated, and he had left school at the age of 8. He was described as a loudmouth person, an eccentric, crude, and distasteful. And as he had come from a lower-class family and merely married into money, he was not accepted whatsoever, and this infuriated him and only made him crave acceptance more.
I loved the severity of how... how severely you said severely. I can't state how dumb he is.
No, you have to. I'm not saying he's necessarily dumb.
Okay, he's severely uneducated.
But he is very uneducated. And that comes in later in the story. That has to be stated that he is uneducated. And that will play a big part in the story later on. Not necessarily dumb. Or at least maybe at this point he might have been dumb. But we'll see what happens to his mental capacity and what happens throughout the story. And you can kind of draw your own conclusion, I suppose, on that.
Sure.
Now, to put himself on the same tier as his neighbors, Dexter noticed quite quickly that they all seemed to have a common attribute. Many of his neighbors had either held, were holding, or worked in some way related to public offices. So he decided to dive right into politics. He did so by quite literally bombarding his previous hometown, Malden, their governing body, with dozens of petitions until they finally relented and created a post for him. He was then known as the Informer of Deer.
Okay. So basically, for anyone who wants a job in politics, you just annoy your local council enough until they basically create a position for you. And so
that has to be how Boris Johnson did it. It has to be.
I was going to say, when you said informer of deer.
Yes.
Can one elaborate on informing the deer? Informing the deer of what?
He didn't inform the actual deer. He didn't go and speak to the deer on the city's behalf.
Okay.
The station required Dexter to keep track of the town's fawn population. However, I have to point out that the town's government records show that the last deer had disappeared from the Malden Woods 19 years before that.
Oh, okay. So basically...
So there were no deer.
He had a very easy gig. Okay.
Yes, yes. They basically said, we'll do this for you. And they gave him a position just to get him to shut him up, basically. But the fact that there had been no deer for the last 20 years, that pretty much seemed lost on Timothy, because he was quite satisfied with his new duty. Obviously, he had just seeked out the position to gain some clout. But with this political position satisfied, Dexter then decided to try to multiply his wealth, which he actually did, but in incredibly odd ways. Now, as we mentioned earlier, America and Great Britain had been on the verge and at the beginning of the Revolutionary War. And during the outset of the war, Congress in America issued America's first form of paper currency, as it had been coins and silver and similar stuff up to that point. And this paper currency was referred to as the Continental Dollar, which ranged wildly in value from a sixth of a dollar to $80. During the Revolution, the currency's value fell drastically. And even though Congress had issued millions of dollars worth of these bills, many vendors refused to accept them. So the cycle of printing the bills and them not being accepted continued until the currency's value fell to an all-time low. And due to that, the phrase, not worth a continental, became a common phrase used to describe an utter lack of value in goods.
Good to know. So basically, if we ever offered a gig where they say, do you take continental dollars?
You say no.
So I say no.
Do not agree to continental dollars. Well, actually, there's more to the story, though.
Here we go.
Well, this is an interesting fact, and I thought this was so interesting, and I'll explain why afterward. But soon, the veterans of the war began to return home. And can you guess which currency the government decided to pay them for their service?
You know, being respectful to the veterans who've served the country, I'm going to guess that they definitely gave them the Continental Dollars.
They sure did. Tons of them. They gave them all Continental Dollars. And because of that, the veterans were instantly destitute.
Wow.
Now, I think this is very interesting because they were pretty much the first veterans. So interestingly, this could have possibly begun the situation of veteran homelessness that perpetuates in America to this day.
Wow.
From the very first American veterans, there's been homeless veterans. How crazy is that?
It's terrible in a way, isn't it? Like, you know,
it's terrible in every way. It's an awful thing.
Yeah, you're very right in pretty much every way, considering it's like basically the greatest sacrifice. And then, not the one, man.
But to boost public confidence and to do a good deed, the neighbors of Dexter, Hancock and Russell, decided to take it upon themselves to buy back some of the bills so they could help out some of the veterans. Now, Dexter decided to emulate them, but he decided to take it much further. Since he saw how willing Americans were to part from the currency for literally any amount, he took all of his savings, as well as all of his wife's savings, and purchased an enormous amount of this currency for literally pennies on the dollar. Now, this was very, very dumb. It was a very dumb move.
Okay, I'm beginning to see where the severely uneducated part of the story is coming in. I'm looking forward to seeing just how bad, though.
Yes. Well, I say it's very dumb, and the reason I say that is because by this point that these bills were being bought back, they had no value. They pretty much were, the currency was pretty much abandoned. Well, there was no possible evidence that this currency would actually be reinstated. Right. So he decided to gamble his entire livelihood and his family's simply because he yearned for the respect of his peers, like John Hancock and Thomas Russell. However, as we said earlier, he was ridiculously lucky. And this gamble actually proved to be fruitful. Once the U.S. Constitution was ratified, it was stipulated that the Continental Dollar could be traded in for Treasury bonds at 1% of their face value. And because he had purchased an insane amount of Continentals, Dexter had instantly and astronomically increased his fortune.
So just relay that to me again. So the Constitution made it that they had a monetary value that they could be swapped for.
Yes.
But only 1% of their original value.
1% of their original value. And he had purchased so much at less than that value that he was able to make an enormous profit off of it. Because they had been so undervalued to the point where they could not be used for anything. So he bought them for so less than 1% of their face value.
Right.
And then when he traded them in, he made an incredible profit. And I mean, a huge fortune. We don't know exact numbers, but it was millions of dollars worth.
Millions and millions and millions.
Exactly, yeah. Now, even further to that, he had been given advice by a neighbor who most likely did not like him to purchase large quantities of European currencies. And now, since the Constitution had been ratified, he was actually able to flip those currencies for even further profit.
Wow.
Adding to his luck.
Insane. So I'm trying to wrap my head around the amount of money he must be making. But at this stage, insane.
It's an insane amount of money. He was making millions of dollars, in at least millions of dollars in today's money.
Yeah, yeah.
Back then, it was probably, you know, a couple hundred bucks. But you know what I mean? It was a lot of money, quite a bit of money.
Yeah, amazing.
Well, he had amassed this incredible, envious fortune, and he believed that he would finally gain credibility within the elite circles of Boston. However, this particular area of his life is where he had no luck at all. And ultimately, Dexter, likely very hurt with how he was treated in Boston, decided that his rejection was more to do with the Bostonian's stodgy nature and not his own eccentricity. So he gathered his family and moved north to the coastal town of Newburyport, where his luck only grew, at least in matters of business.
I like the outlook for moving. It's like, you couldn't handle me. You didn't deserve me at my worst, so you don't get me at my best, sort of thing.
Exactly, yeah. He was a character. I mean, to describe him as personality-wise, he was just a complete character. He, like we said earlier, he was very loud-mouthed and eccentric, and people just did not like being around him. But he just wanted people to like him so bad, at least in the upper class. He just wanted to be known as this person. He didn't want to be known as the lower class man that married into money. And he tried everything he could to change it. And he did change it, but he couldn't change the way people thought of him.
Right.
Which is quite sad, actually.
It is very sad.
Now, records show that Newburyport was an idyllic town where rich and poor both intermingled and where the population was not so large as to hide any individual, however odd or humble. And even with this knowledge, Dexter aimed to make a spectacle from the moment he arrived. He purchased a full fleet of shipping vessels for seemingly no reason. He purchased a stable of cream-colored horses and a lavish coach complete with his initials plastered on the side. And then he built a chateau fit for a prince overlooking the sea, which was filled with the most lavish furnishings money could buy, including tasteful and commodious outhouses.
I literally, as soon as you said the whole fleet of ships thing, what jumped into my head and making a spectacle was the scene from Aladdin, you know, Prince Ali, yes it is he, Ali Ababa. That's legitimately what came into my head.
He showed up.
But sailing instead. I don't know why.
Yeah. With Elton John to the side playing grand piano on one of the ships. Just Well, the historian Samuel L. Knapp recounted that Dexter also commissioned the carving and mounting of more than 40 giant wooden statues on his property, and each of them depicted a great character of American lore. And Knapp described the estate as follows. The tasteless owner, in his rage for notoriety, created rows of columns, 15 feet high at least, on which to place colossal statues carved in wood. Directly in front of the door of the house, on a Roman arch of great beauty and taste, stood General Washington in his military garb. On his left was Thomas Jefferson, on his right, Henry Adams. On the columns in the garden, there were figures of Indian chiefs, military generals, philosophers, politicians, statesmen, and the goddesses of fame and liberty. But finally, Dexter, not wanting to be outdone, erected a final statue of himself. He then painted an inscription beneath it that read, "I am the first in the East, I am the first in the West, and the greatest philosopher in the Western world," although he had never done or contributed anything at all to philosophy in any way.
I love that. And that's technically, it's like social media in a way. But I mean, for me, if I had to wake up every morning and I surrounded myself with like for instance, like all the musician idols I'd have, I'd probably just be a bit like, oh God, I feel small. But instead he does the full, no, I'm going to proclaim myself the best at something, even though no one else knows, no one else knows how good I am at it. I'm great on the inside.
Yeah, exactly. Now, each of those particular statues were $2,000 a piece. And the combined total of all of the statues, it added up to twice the amount that Dexter had paid for his entire estate.
Wow.
But the statues did garner the public's attention, which was his only goal.
Well, congratulations, sir.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, likely tired of Dexter's eccentricities and constantly fighting for fame and attention and living in an eyesore of a home, Elizabeth grew tired of the embarrassment and moved to another estate in the neighborhood, leaving behind Dexter's son. And similar to Dexter, his son had no interest in learning. And soon, what was previously the family home had been turned into somewhat of a brothel, which included long nights of drinking in which women came and went, and the previous fine interiors, which had included curtains that were once owned by the Queen of France, became covered in unseemly stains, offensive to sight and smell.
Just before we continue, okay, we say Liz left him. I'm going to call her shorthand Liz. Sorry, I just Liz'd her.
Cool. Yeah.
So Liz left him with a son and it immediately turned into a brothel. My question is, how old is the son at this stage?
At this point, he's got to be late teens.
Right, okay.
At some point, but we don't know. We don't even know his son's name because it wasn't found in history. We don't even know his son. He has a daughter as well, and I think the mother took the daughter with him, hopefully. But the we don't know the son, how old he was, but he was old enough, likely to be in his late teens or early 20s maybe, because at this point Dexter's getting up there to at least middle age or late 30s, or maybe late 30s to middle age, somewhere around there.
Right, I like that. That even if he's like, "Daddy, what's my name?" Old enough is what your name is.
Exactly, yeah. Well, as we mentioned earlier, Dexter had purchased a fleet of ships for seemingly no reason, but he soon announced after his divorce, or at least after his wife left him, I don't think they were ever legitimately divorced because he's too eccentric to do that, but he soon announced that he had intentions to launch a business in international trade, and his neighbors, very likely tired of how of his new bachelor ways and his old eccentricities, decided to use this as an opportunity to bankrupt him in the hopes that he would then be forced to move out of the town.
Still very well loved.
Yes, absolutely. People hated him so much, and I feel so bad for him because he didn't necessarily do anything that warranted being hated. He was probably just hard to deal with.
Yeah.
But people just did not like him. And it's actually very sad, and yeah. I think the story has a sad ending as well, but I feel like we know, all of us know a person like this. We know a person that tries too hard to be liked.
All of Instagram.
Yeah, all you guys out there. By the way, I'm going to upload a new photo tonight about the podcast. Check it out. Share it with your friends, please.
I love how I've just effectively slagged off our current audience and any other audience just because they use Instagram. I'm a massive hypocrite.
You sure are. I've seen your photos, Sam. They're quite good, actually.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Now, the plan of the neighbors was to provide Dexter with terrible investment opportunities. In one particular moment, a neighbor suggested that Dexter should sell warming pans in the West Indies. And warming pans, if you've seen Pirates of the Caribbean, there's actually one used in the first Pirates of the Caribbean. But they're flat pans that are placed under mattresses to warm beds.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And the West Indies is an area of islands known for year-round hot weather. Dexter, obviously not affluent enough to research this opportunity, quickly just decided to try his hand and purchased 42,000 of the pans.
Oh, man.
And for this, he actually needed 9 shipping vessels to carry them. It was so much product. And he quickly set off to sell these pans, all the while the experienced traders were laughing right behind his back.
I'm desperate. I'm kind of almost at this stage want to know, did he just arrive there and go, huh? Check him out. They're going to make things even hotter. And they just looked at him and were just like, get in the sea.
Yes, that's what happened. He arrived in the West Indies and quickly found out that there was no use for bed warmers, possibly stepping off of the ship and going, holy crap, it's very hot. It's a tropical climate. There is no cold whatsoever. These are useless. Or he probably went and just said, eh, and they said no.
Or do you need a frying pan with a very long handle?
Well, similar to that, and somewhat ingeniously, he decided to rebrand the pans as ladles. He then sold them to sugar and molasses plantation owners in the area, and he found that there was an incredible demand, and it was so great that all of the owners would buy three or four at one time. And Dexter marked up the pans by 79%, sold them all, and returned home with an even greater fortune.
Oh my God, that's amazing. Ingenious.
He is the luckiest man. I don't know if he necessarily made the choice to rebrand them, or maybe somebody was with them that made the choice to rebrand him. Yeah. I don't know, but he is so lucky. And the next story is actually even more so.
Plus, 79%. Wow.
79%. Yeah, that's an incredible markup. I mean, you're looking today, most people mark up 25, 30%. 45 maybe is a high percent. 79% is a hell of a profit.
That's insane.
Now, in another unfortunate trick on Dexter, a trader maliciously convinced him that there was a great demand for coal in Newcastle. However, Dexter, again, did not have the foresight to research this. And if he had, he would know that there was already a very well-established coal mine in Newcastle, meaning that any foreign shipment was completely useless.
Right.
However...
Here we go again.
When Dexter arrived, he found that the coal mine, miraculously, was on strike. And there was an enormous need for his coal, and he sold the coal for another huge markup and once again returned home with an even bigger fortune.
You couldn't write this, could you? It's almost like a Looney Tunes cartoon. Like, you know, every time Wile E. Coyote tries to, like, kill the Roadrunner, and every time he just lucks into something better.
Every single time. It's insane. He is so lucky, and it's so sad that these guys are trying to trick him into failing, into going destitute, but he, every single time, he, like, not at least triples, he at least adds another third to his giant fortune that just keeps going. He never loses. He must have been a Sagittarius.
I was going to say, is he like two for two now on being duped and then somehow ending up with a ridiculous amount more money? Which at this stage... Is it three for three now? Oh, wow.
Three for three because he bought up the Continental Dollar that made him instantly rich. And then the pans and the coal. He's literally every single business decision he's made, including marrying Elizabeth, has been incredibly fruitful for him.
Poor old Liz.
I know. Well, she got out of it, so. Well, actually, she comes back in a moment.
There we go.
Now, it's around this time that some historians believe that Dexter actually developed a bit of business intellect and knowledge of trading techniques. He basically found that you could basically find a good that's in demand and then sell it. That's pretty much a bare minimum of market analysis, you know what I mean? But he had enough money at this point to do that effectively. And at one point, he decided to purchase 340 tons of whalebone, which when he purchased them, wasn't necessarily worth much of anything. But because of the amount that he purchased, he effectively monopolized the entire whalebone market. And in yet another ridiculous stroke of good luck, whalebone went on to be used in multitudes of goods, including corsets, toys, and typewriters. And it was such a popular commodity that it is still, to this day, known as the plastic of the 1800s.
That's amazing. I was going to say, even like at this point, when you say like he developed like a kind of like a business acumen, if you will, I was going to be like, please don't let him. He seems to be doing all right, not knowing anything.
Let him just run on luck.
Yeah.
He's doing fine as he is. Yeah, absolutely. Even though he had amassed a ridiculous fortune, he still yearned to be accepted by the elite upper class. He had not just made a name for himself in Newburyport, he was also well known for his eccentricities far beyond his coastal town. Although his goal was to be considered a noble gentleman, his actions constantly kept him from that moniker. he started to emulate wealthy people as much as possible. He would purchase lavish libraries of books, and he would order his servants to build a collection of works of art just because he found that the rich French decided that they enjoyed them so much. And even though he hadn't gained noble friends, he started to surround himself with really eccentric people, which were likely the only people that would kind of be his friend, which is another sad point.
Oh, man.
Now, of these notable friends of his was John P., who was a failed headmaster who decided to open up his own school and taught science, although he had no knowledge of the subject whatsoever. Madam Hooper, a rich local widow who was turned to a fortune teller who would give Dexter astrology advice in exchange for tea. And a 20-year-old halibut salesman whom Dexter decided to hire as his own personal poet laureate because he heard that noble people did that. They had people that made poems for them. And he would hire him to stand out in his garden and recite poems just about him, Timothy Dexter.
He assembled like the world's worst Avengers.
Yeah.
Like hundreds of years earlier.
Madame Hooper!
What's your power? Oh, if you give me tea, I'll tell you something about the sky.
Yeah, I'll read your sign. Well, soon after that, and after his collection of misfits, Dexter declared himself as Lord and instructed his surgeons and guardsmen and friends to refer to him as such, thus becoming Lord Timothy Dexter. He actually did not earn the title of Lord, and I do believe that there were no lords in America at the time or since.
Brilliant. So before you could even buy it, why don't we all just do that? You just set a preface and just be like, if you went around telling people you were just a lord, they'd be like, oh, you just kind of follow.
Well, you can
on.
Become a lord. My father-in-law, he's a lord. He bought a, his wife bought him a tiny portion of land, very tiny portion of land up in Scotland, and that
Amazing.
Makes him a lord of that land.
That's incredible.
Yeah, it's like me being a minister.
As we said, to own some land is pretty cool. Lord of the land. Lord of this small acre somewhere.
But they don't have to know how big the land is. It could be, you know, an inch by an inch, you know? Well, even though he had this forced adulation that he was getting from his servants and peers, Dexter knew that there was still a lack of respect for him. He was smart enough to know that people didn't legitimately respect him. Or at least he didn't know if they did or not. And from his point of view, he believed they didn't. So, as most level-headed people would do, he decided to fake his own death in an attempt to throw a fake funeral to see how the public really felt about him.
Oh my God, he pulled a Ross before Ross did Ross as well. Oh, Jesus.
But it must be said that I'm not sure, and we here at Unfortunate History are not sure of his mental capacity at this time. Some believe that Dexter began to truly lose his mind. They believe that his mental capacity was deteriorating throughout his entire life. But it's really difficult to determine this when you compare it to this decision to his usual eccentricities. So we're not necessarily sure if he was or was not going crazy, but some people believe that he actually was. But nonetheless, Dexter began his funeral preparations by building a grandiose tomb that occupied the entire basement of a summer home. He then hired the best cabinet maker to craft a coffin of the finest mahogany available, which Dexter found to be so well made, he actually slept in it for several weeks. Because he's totally sane.
I love that. It's like, listen, I'm going to, at one point in my life, by that, I mean, at the end of it, I'm going to spend a lot of time in here. So I'm just gonna sleep in it for a while. See how it gets to grips with it.
Oh, I'm loving this. Yeah. Well, actually, they are technically, if you're very rich, you can buy a really comfy coffin. Not that I've slept in many, but I can just say that. Yeah.
I mean, it would weird me out if you'd slept in any. Not many. I mean, any.
Anyways. Well, for this ruse to work, Dexter entrusted a few of his men to plan the mock funeral, and they handed out small cards showing the news of Dexter's death to everyone in the community. And Dexter also let his wife and children in on the hoax, but demanded that they act the part. Specifically, he wanted them to appear completely distraught over his parting. Now, as far as funerals go, Dexter's was actually somewhat of a success. 3,000 people showed up, and it was a grand affair with exotic liquors and the finest wines being poured. But I suppose we can't really know if those 300 attendees attended to mourn or to celebrate. But either way, Dexter felt like the day was a success. That is, until he saw his wife.
Uh-oh. So hang on, did you say 3,000 people showed up or 300?
3,000 people showed up. Oh, so 3,000.
3,000, wow. Okay.
Yeah, pretty much the whole town. I'm not sure what the Newburyport population was at this time, but a good majority of the town showed up to his funeral. Now, Dexter's children were playing their part really successfully. His son had got drunk enough to weep on command, and he was having no trouble. And his daughter was burying her head in her hands. But Dexter saw her, his wife, and she was completely tearless and smiling ear to ear. Probably happy with the image of seeing her husband dead. But we're not 100% sure. Now, Dexter approached his wife secretly in the kitchen. He confronted her and then callously caned her for her apparent lack of effort, which makes him quite a bit of a dick. But this caused a lot of commotion. And guests started entering the kitchen to investigate the scene. And they found the supposedly dead Dexter smiling like a child who had just been caught doing a bad deed. He then proceeded to go about his own funeral, speaking to the mourners as if the entire thing hadn't happened.
That's just great. What an insane story. Oh,
I mean,
goodness.
He's such an eccentric man. But he's doing all this just for the acceptance. It's insane how far he's going for this acceptance. He's literally faked his own death just to see how people would react. But he was super happy about it. He was super happy to see all the people around. But it still didn't fix how he felt about not being accepted into the upper class.
That is just hilarious. I'm just trying to think of like how you fake it out. Welcome to my funeral. Thank you. Are you enjoying yourself? But aren't you just... Yeah.
He didn't even welcome to his funeral. He just said, oh, hey, how's it going, Bob? How are you? Yeah, no, good to see you. Yeah, all right. Would you like a drink? I'll grab you a drink. Yeah, and then they're just like, you were supposed to be dead.
And he was like, forget about it. What about that drink?
Yeah, supposed to be dead, I heard. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know, crazy stuff. Anyways, I'll see you later. Like, Timothy. Years following Timothy Dexter's first funeral were filled with similar eccentric activities. He decided that his next big pursuit would be to achieve immortality. And to do so, he would follow in the footsteps of many, and many of those that he admired, and publish a memoir. Now, this is where the uneducated part comes in. And as we said earlier, Dexter was severely uneducated, having left school at the age of 8. He had no knowledge of writing or penmanship, but he still set out to produce a written work to rival Shakespeare, and I believe that's a direct quote from himself.
Wow. I'm imagining already how it's going to look, and it's just like, look at my masterpiece, and it's just squiggly line, squiggly
line.
Squiggly line.
You're not ready. You're not ready. He titled this book, A Pickle for the Knowing Ones, or Plain Truths in a Homespun Dress.
Wait, A Pickle?
For the Knowing Ones.
And then...
Or Plain Truths in a Homespun Dress.
Okay. A distinctive title, I'll give you that.
It was very distinctive, yeah. But the book was grossly misspelled and completely lacked any sort of punctuation.
Brilliant. Just, and then.
This made the entire work a completely incomprehensible mess. As an example... I have a few lines from the beginning of the book
Brilliant.
That I'm going to read to you now. And I will read this as it's spelled as well. So I will read it how it's misspelled. To mankind, at large the time is come, at last the grat day of rejoicing. What is that? Why I will tell you, those three kings in raced, you me and... Thought should know raced on the first royal arch in the world, almost, no quite, but very huey upon, so they are good mark to be seen, so the woman's lick to see the fruit, and all people loves to see them as the Quakers will come and piap slyly.
That was incredible. That was like you know when you use that like reader function on old school Microsoft, and then, and then, and then. That was...
But there's no and thens. There's no and thens. He's just writing them as just sentences with no punctuation whatsoever. And it's so misspelled. It's like Old English. It's crazy. It's like how Beowulf was spelled back in when it was first first written, which is very old and very difficult to read. And instead of selling this work, Dexter decided to hand out the book to people on the street, as a lot of rich people did at the time. They actually wrote their memoirs and gave them away for free. Now, to the surprise of many, and maybe Dexter or not, it became very popular.
Wow.
And it actually demanded a second printing. In the second printing, in response to the criticism that he had not added any punctuation, Dexter included in the second publishing a full page of punctuation as the final page of the book. And on this page, he instructed the reader to salt and pepper the marks as they wish.
Oh, that's so great. You've essentially just given someone a book and just written it intentionally badly and said, by the way, here's the punctuation, the stuff that's actually going to make it legible. Just put it where you think it should be. It's almost like an exam. It's like a kid's exam for punctuation. Here's all the work. Go and fix it. It's basically, he's basically training the people who probably hundreds of years from now would go on to develop Grammarly.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, absolutely. I think so.
Brilliant.
This book, it's hard because some people describe it as him making fun or playing on the fact that he did not know how to spell. Some people think that he played on the fact and made fun of people with higher educations, because it was said that he didn't actually trust anybody with a college education. He didn't like them. He was kind of he was a lower class man, but he didn't like these people who thought they knew better. So he wrote this book to say, I can write a book. I have enough money to do this, and I'm going to take the piss out of you. Because you can't read it, pretty much.
That's just, I'm speechless. You know when you're just like, I don't know whether or not to pity you or whether or not I should be aspiring to be you. I'm caught somewhere in the middle.
Right. I know. I would have been his friend. I don't understand why. But people did not like him. They, unless they were like really eccentric people, they just did not like him. But interestingly, almost a century after his book's release, Dexter was still receiving praise, if not somewhat satirically, about the memoir. He would receive reviews in monthly printings, like local magazines, possibly making it more of a success than Dexter had ever thought it would be.
Amazing.
Yeah. Well, all good stories, unfortunately, do have to come to an end. And on October 26th, 1806, just a few years after publishing his book, Lord Timothy Dexter passed away for the final time.
I thought that that's an important caveat on the whole thing.
Yes.
He's actually dead this time.
Well, in his final days, he had sought to right some of the wrongs that he had made in his life, and he tried to atone for the errors through the use of his will. Now, his estate was divvied up equally between his children, wife, and his friends, and all of them were said to be very happy with the outcome, so they all received enough to please them. His wooden statues, though, unfortunately, were knocked loose by a strong gale of wind and only fetched 50 cents to $5, although they had all been commissioned at $2,000 each.
Yeesh.
Now, this next part is my saddest part of Timothy Dexter. I feel very bad for him, but perhaps the saddest moment in Dexter's life was the end. It could have been an attempt to truly erase Dexter from the town's history, but Newburyport's Board of Health actually rejected Dexter's final wish to be buried in the tomb he had built earlier for his fake funeral, and the reasoning was due to it being unsanitary. So the Lord was instead laid to rest in a small cemetery somewhere hidden in the hills, where his headstone was quickly covered in wheatgrass, symbolically erasing his name from history.
Oh, that is pretty sad.
It's very sad. Now, I suppose that you have to really admire Dexter's appreciation for his own eccentricities. He did not change who he was to be accepted by the upper class. He continued being Timothy Dexter till the day he died, but he just tried to accomplish many things that the upper class would see as an impressive accomplishment.
Mm.
There's a biographer Samuel Knapp, and he wrote that Dexter had a way of his own. He was a living exception to all general rules and a living contradiction to all maxims of human wisdom. Now, Lord Timothy Dexter truly died unceremoniously and was mostly forgotten by history, never having achieved the acceptance of the elite circles of society he so desperately craved, as well as alienating those closest to him. He died a lonely man known as an eccentric, a person one would rather know about than know personally. And that, my friends, is what's truly unfortunate.
Ooh, great ending.
Nailed it.
Nailed it. Man.
Yeah.
That is... I what a fascinating person. And I can totally see what you mean by lucky. Like, everything seemed to work out, I guess, other than... other than his dying wish. And the acceptance thing, I suppose. But
yeah, he lived his life and based every decision off of being accepted. Yeah. Everything that he did was on acceptance. He married Elizabeth, what most people argue, that he married his wife to gain her fortune so that he could be accepted into the upper class. And then he bought up the money that the other upper class people were buying up because he wanted to emulate them and to copy them and show, I can do this as well. And then whenever he was told about a business opportunity, he decided to do it because he wanted to be accepted by those people, but he didn't necessarily know that they were, you know, taking the piss on him and wanting him to fail and banking on that. And then he just kick him while he's down. Right when he dies, he built an incredibly grandiose tomb. This tomb, I mean, he had so much money. There was no way this tomb was not exquisite. And they decided, no, you're not going to be buried there. You're going to be buried in this small cemetery hidden in the hills where no one will see and hear about you again. And nobody really did. He's kind of lost to history.
I mean, it is truly sad. I mean, there are questions that just jump out now that I'm sort of looking back on things. I wonder what Miss Liz Frothingham, I mean, what did she gain out of their marriage?
Well, he did woo her. It is said that he wooed her, and I would assume he wooed her at least.
Not with handwritten poems.
Yeah.
Squiggly, no, squiggly line. If I were to compare thee to a squiggly line.
No, I think what if I were to argue it, I think that he likely wooed her, and he did probably care about her. He cared about her enough to have a family with her.
Yeah.
But I think he liked the draw of her money as well. I think that was a great addition. And that could have been his main factor. Mm. But that doesn't necessarily mean that he didn't care for her. And she probably got out of it a hardworking, interesting person to have a conversation with. But at the end of the day, he was just too eccentric for her to stay.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of my things. I still love the... I mean, some of my favorite notes from this, because I'm just looking back on some notes I made. Informer of Dia. Love it. I mean, the 79% markup on pans, that's some like Dr. Dre Beats level stuff there.
Oh my God, I know. He was a very lucky and, I guess, towards the end, very good businessman. I mean, when you have millions and millions of dollars, I think you kind of just become good at money. You know, what else are you going to do?
Like, I mean,
you've got all this money. It's just going to multiply.
I mean, let's say that there are some statistics that argue some individuals are not as good as that as some others.
I suppose so, yeah. Richard Branson.
Yeah, for one. Some leaders of state are
others. That's true. Yeah.
And I'm waiting until...
Getting political. Getting political here on Unfortunate History.
Uh-oh.
Well, that's the show. If you guys would like to follow Unfortunate History and learn more about us and learn when we release our episodes, I try to release every Saturday, but if we get put behind and all that, I try to post it on the social media. But you can find us on Facebook and Instagram at Unfortunate History, and then on Twitter at UnhistoryPod. Next week, we're going to be covering a really interesting topic, and it's going to be a two-parter topic, and we're going to dive into the crime and the underbelly of London and its crime world hidden in the East End. And that's a little hint for what we're going for next week. But I won't tell you what the episode is yet, but it will be a two-parter and it will be very research intensive. So I'm buckling up and ready for that. Yeah. And if you want to follow me, my name is Cody Pennington. You can just find me by Googling Cody Pennington and find all my relevant stuff. And Sam Brown, do you want to do any shout outs to anything or links to anything?
Yeah. I don't know what they are. Can't think of them. No, big shout out to everyone who's listening to the show. Thanks for joining us. And for anyone who's checked it out, I guess if you're interested in seeing what I'm up to, which at the moment isn't an awful lot and probably not too dissimilar from a lot of people out there, you can follow me at the longest Instagram handle ever, which is Sam T.A. Brown Musician. At Sam T.A. Brown Musician.
Snappy. Snappy.
I really need to start like another one or rebrand. Oh, God.
No, it's good. I like it. I enjoy it. I'm going to follow you. I hope I did. I don't think I did follow you yet. I'm so sorry, Sam. We are friends, I promise. All right, everybody. Please stay tuned. Follow us on Spotify and all that so you can see all the new episodes. And we got a lot of new content coming out for you. I've got a ton of episodes planned out. And like I said, next week's going to be really cool. Going to be more crime-driven. There are a few murders involved and all that. So it's going to be some juicy stuff next week. But I hope you enjoyed learning a bit of history this week about the Boston Tea Party and the American Revolutionary War. Sam, did you enjoy it?
I have learned things, which for me is always a success.
That's all we need. I just want you to enjoy your time and learn a little bit while you're doing it, and then hopefully have some useless dinner conversation that you can probably tell your friends and family so that they can say, we really don't like having this guy over. Can you please stop inviting him over? He does not shut up about this Timothy Dexter fellow.
It's nice because at the moment, I suppose me and my girlfriend have dinner and go, what did you do today? I don't know, probably the same thing you did today. So it's nice to have a slightly different topic of conversation.
It's cool, yeah. Go and tell her. I bet she'll be like, wow, that's quite interesting. Oh,
she found the last one quite interesting. So,
oh, really good. Oh, I'm glad. You know, actually, we've had some comments from listeners that have said that they think it's quite interesting and that they've enjoyed the episodes and stuff so far. And they, I'm hoping that we can keep it going. And I'm trying to find the most interesting stories. I know today was more history heavy, but I hope it was still interesting enough to learn about this guy's life because he was an interesting person
for sure.
Well, anyways, we got to go. And you know what? It's funny because somebody somebody hashtagged our last tagline, which was stay unfortunate. So I can't decide if I want to go. You know what? How about this? Unfortunately, we got to go. But stay unfortunate. We'll just use them both.
Stay unfortunate.
That's right.
Great.
All right, everybody. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Sam, for being here. Have a good one.
Yes. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye. Bye.